From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Charlotte Gordon joins us as a featured speaker with a 2009 Jewish Book Fair. She has published two books of poetry and a biography of the 17th century poet Anne Bradstreet, which won a New England Book Award for nonfiction. Charlotte received an undergraduate degree in English and American Literature from Harvard University and a PhD from Boston University. As a postdoctoral fellow at Boston, she taught religion and literature, and for several years was a lecturer in Elie Wiesel's seminar, The Literature of Memory. Since 1986, Charlotte has taught creative writing, history, literature, religion, and theater at both college and secondary school levels. Her latest book, The Woman Who Named God, Abraham's Dilemma and the Birth of Three Faiths, it retells the famous biblical story of Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar. Welcome, Charlotte Gordon. And that is a long introduction you today.
Yes.
I am very much looking forward to talking to you about this book, which you have right here. And tell me a little bit about the writing of this book. How did you start off with it, and what led you into the writing of this particular book?
Well, first of all, Doug, thank you for having me on the show. And I never intended to write this book ever. But I think, like so many Americans, I come from a mixed religion family. But I didn't know this. And I was raised as a Christian, and church was very much at the center of our lives. And when I was 12 years old, I found out that my father had actually been born Jewish, but had never shared this information with us. And so that was a surprise to me. And when I would try to talk to my dad about this, he had a pretty complicated relationship to his Jewish heritage. And that set me out on a kind of journey to find out more about Jewish history, Jewish literature, and Jewish religion. And I certainly didn't think that I was going to fall in love with the Jewish religion, but I did. And along the way, really became a student, I suppose, of the Bible, of Hebrew, of Aramaic, and fell in love with this one particular story in Genesis, which is the story of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar. And the story is, I'm sure most, well, I don't know actually how many people are still familiar with this story, but Abraham is divided by his love for two different women, his first wife, Sarah, and his second wife or concubine, Hagar. And it's out of this division that we get the story of the origins of all three monotheistic religions. So Sarah, his first wife, is the traditional mother of Isaac, who's the grandfather of the Jewish people, according to the Bible. And Hagar is the mother of Ishmael, who goes on to become the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather of Muhammad. And so Hagar becomes the mother, really, of Islam. So out of this divided family, we have the origins, supposedly, of Judaism and of Islam. And Christians stake a claim in there also, but that's also another story.
Okay. The next book.
Maybe. It's in this book, too. In this book.
So tell me, when you started writing this, what you've already done a lot of background in the literature and the history. What other kind of preparations did you have to do for it? How did you start out the writing? What was your process?
Well, you know, as I said, I didn't think I was going to be writing this book. Mm-hmm. But one day in Hebrew class, we were reading this story from Genesis, and the rabbi came to the word vayira in Hebrew, and he said, so does anyone here know what vayira means? And nobody was very sure what vayira meant, but it means, he says, divided, paralyzed, and in despair. Abraham was vayira. He was paralyzed, depressed, and in despair. And I remember thinking, wow, I feel that way a lot, you know? I can kind of identify with this biblical patriarch. Who knew? Who would ever think? And Abraham was divided, says the Bible, because his first wife, Sarah, comes to him and tells him to send his second wife away into the desert. And he doesn't want to. He loves her. And he also loves her child, Ishmael. But so he is vayira, but God says, listen, you've got to do what your first wife says. And so he does. So I thought, what is this story? And I became obsessed with it, actually. It's a little embarrassing to admit, but mm-hmm. I did. And
how did you become obsessed about a biblical story? I mean, what creates this obsession? What were you doing that was...
I think I was troubled by the story because this idea that in the West, we tend to think as Christians and Jews that we that Abraham and Sarah are our spiritual parents in some ways. And in fact, if you convert to Judaism, which I did do, you end up taking Abraham and Sarah as your parents. That's one of the sort of traditions. Mm-hmm. And it just was troubling to me as a story that these parents of ours would be responsible for exiling this woman into the desert. And I think it was troubling. So obsession for me takes the form of reading. Again, no idea that a book was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But I think that in 2003, I heard the war in Iraq described as a battle between the sons of Sarah and the sons of Hagar. And that's when I realized that my personal obsession really had to go into the world, mm-hmm. because I felt like if I could figure out how to tell this story with more compassion and more sophistication and intelligence, you know, now this is going to sound so naive, but this is the hope, you know, maybe there would be a chance for redemption. Maybe there wouldn't have to be the kind of violence that we've witnessed because of the historical clashes between religions.
So when you were reading about this, where do you start reading on something like this? You were reading the Hebrew Bible, you'd read the Christian Bible. What other, well, actually at that point they're the same, right, with that story. Yeah. So what other kind of historical documents did you consult but when you were reading about this?
Well, I read the Christian commentators. I read the Jewish commentators. I mean, as many as I could. And I also ventured into reading Muslim commentators. And that was the most fascinating part of all. That's the part I really loved.
Why is that?
Well, I learned a whole other side to the story. In Judaism and Christianity, the story is that Abraham and Sarah exile Hagar into the desert, where she goes with her little child and almost dies, but God intervenes and saves her, and then she goes off and she's fine and she starts a new people with her son. So it's a complicated story that I think we feel kind of guilty about, you know, the tragic victim Hagar. But in Islam, Hagar actually volunteers to go off into the desert. She says to her husband Abraham, she says, I know that we need to spread the word of the one true God, Allah, and so I will go with you to help you do that. So he takes her by the hand, and instead of taking her to the desert, which is the desert of the Torah or the Bible, he leads her, in fact, all the way to Mecca, which actually doesn't exist yet. She's about to invent it. Mm-hmm. But he leads her to Mecca, and he leaves her there alone, which she's sad about, but then she understands that it's the way of God, so she stays with her baby Ishmael. And as in the Bible, she gets really thirsty, and the baby's on the brink of death. You know, they need water. And in the Bible, she just bursts into tears, and God shows her a well, and all is well. In Islam, she practically puts on her track shoes. It's such a great story. She shows so much initiative. She gets up, and she runs to the nearest mountain, and she climbs to the top of the mountain, and she looks all over for water, but she can't find it anywhere. So she runs back down the mountain and she runs up the next mountain. She looks everywhere for water. She can't find it. So she repeats this 7 times. And finally, the angel of God comes to her and says, look, here's water. He strikes the earth with his heel. She runs to it. She drinks from it. But then she does something really miraculous, according to Islam. In fact, Muhammad calls her the most blessed of all women. She actually engineers or makes a well, which may not seem very exciting to us, but if you're a desert dweller, which she was, she knew that she had to trap the water and keep it for posterity. Otherwise, just springs on the surface of the desert are going to evaporate. And in fact, the well that she makes becomes the holiest water traditionally in Islam. It's called the Zamzam, the well. And every year, and in fact, about a week or two, Muslims every year on their Hajj to Mecca reenact Hagar's journey back and forth, running back and forth between the two hills, and also drinking from the well that she actually builds with her own hands. So in Islam, I discovered this amazing Hagar, this woman filled with initiative and courage, who was an engineer, and also some marauding tribes people go by when she's next to her well with her baby, and they want to drink from the water, and she fends them off. I love this as a, you know, a single mother. She fends them off and says, no, 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 the water rights are for my son Ishmael, and they go away. So she's
not too marauding, really. More no, fairly
right.
polite.
They were polite marauders.
Right, right.
And then, so she is an incredible sort of formidable force. Mm-hmm. And I really loved seeing her through that lens, mm-hmm. from victim to matriarch. It was very inspirational.
Okay. Do you have a favorite passage from the book that you might like to share?
This is the passage that I would sit as I was contemplating my conversion to Judaism. Every year during the high holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, this particular story is read. And that was another part of my bewilderment and sort of fascination with the story, is why would the story of Hagar, who's traditionally not an Israelite or a Jew, why would Jews every year sit and listen to this story? Mm-hmm. So this is my imagining of the story.
Okay.
A heartbroken man stands at the threshold of his tent, watching the desert unfold. It is daybreak, and golden hills ripple gently across the horizon. He knows how dangerous the sands can be. Giant dunes shift in the wind. The nearest well is at least a day's journey away. By the time the sun has reached its peak, the heat will be unbearable. The man's name is Abraham, and it is into this wilderness that he has banished two members of his camp, his second wife and the teenage son he loves. He watches them now as they fill sacks with lentils and water. He helps the woman strap on her pack, but says nothing to her. There's nothing left to say. He knows she and the boy have little chance of survival. They will face suffocating heat, dust storms, and paralyzing despair. He's certain he'll never see them again. The woman's name is Hagar, and Abraham's relationship with her has nearly ruined his life. The young man beside her is Abraham's firstborn son, Ishmael. Standing behind Abraham is his first wife, Sarah, a woman whose legendary beauty has made pharaohs and kings desperate for her love. In her arms, Sarah holds a little boy, Isaac, born after decades of prayer and aggravation. Sarah can't help but feel triumphant now, confident in both her husband's fidelity and the belief that her son will become Abraham's only heir. When Sarah turns away, Abraham stares after Hagar, memorizing her shape, listening for Ishmael's voice. He watches until their shadows grow fainter. As soon as the figures have disappeared into the desert, he, Sarah, and Isaac go together into their tent. Abraham has obeyed his wife's demands to reject Hagar and Ishmael, just as God had commanded him to do. But it is less clear that he's adhered to the second part of God's command. Do not be distressed over the boy or the woman. How can he stop thinking about them? How can he stop worrying about their fate? Really, how can I stop worrying about their fate?
Okay. So how long did the book take you to write after you had decided that you were going to make it a book, some amount of time into the research behind it?
I would say, you know, it's funny with books. I'll bet lots of your authors tell you that. In some ways, they begin when we're children, I think. But
not a lot, no.
Really?
Not,
okay,
not
well, this book had its origins in my childhood. But the actual writing and research of the book, I suppose, took about 6 years, 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm. And you've got, I was trying to come up with a genre to put it in, and I thought, well, you know, it's a reimagining of something. So in some ways it's fiction, but it's also got a large number of footnotes. Mm. So it's academic. So, you know, where do you place it on the spectrum of literature available?
You know, in a funny way, it's like a biography. It's a literary biography. It mm-hmm. is nonfiction. So my own speculation isn't actually in the book, but mm-hmm. the speculation of others is.
But you're
in the
creating
book.
The scenes, though.
I do, okay.
Right, so
the
there's some. You know.
That's true. I try and make it come alive for my reader, mm-hmm. and I try and make it read like a novel. I do. Okay. But I don't actually make anything up. Okay. So what I do is I tell the story, and then I pause here and there, and I say, huh. This is an interesting part of the story. What do Jews make of this? What do Christians make of this? What do Muslims make of this? And then I go back to the story. So I try and keep it moving along, but I also think as I'm telling the story, and I want my reader to think also, because of course, One of the things that I have found, I don't know, problematic, I think, about the book's reception in the world is, well, first of all, this is my first time ever getting hate mail, which I think is really, it's a unique experience. And I've been getting hate mail from a certain kind of Christian, actually, who is a very precise reader. People who like the book are always kind of vague. They just write me and say, hey, I really liked the book. But I've noticed that my critics write me emails that go something like this. Page 133, chapter 22, you are a heretic. And I, you know, think, do I want to read this email or don't I want to read this email? They're so specific. So I never intended this book to be a Christian book, a Jewish book, or a Muslim book. I really saw this book as an opportunity for the three traditions to examine the story that we all have in common. And so it's a book for non-believers. It's a book for believers. It's really a book for people to understand our cultural legacy. What is this story that, for better or worse, has shaped people's actions and is one of the driving forces for Iraq and now Afghanistan? And in fact, in Israel today, if you were to interview one of the settlers, you would hear them cite this story as the reason why they should, you know, get to be in the settlements. And if you talk to a Palestinian, they too will cite this story. So the story has amazing implications for today. Mm-hmm. And again, it's probably because I'm an intellectual, but my hope is that if people actually knew the story and could retell the story in a different way, in a way that has biblical basis, there actually might be more hope, because the Bible at no point says that Ishmael, the Muslim, should be disenfranchised. No, 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 God says Ishmael is blessed. God gives a double blessing to Isaac and to Ishmael. And so there is not actually biblical basis. If you're going to be somebody who lives, you know, with the Bible as a kind of blueprint, the Bible does not give any excuse for the kind of violence and warfare that we have seen.
Now, you said you had also done research into not just the Christian Bible, but you're doing it from both sides with the other two religions. You had talked about some of the differences that you found. Do you find that played out? You said that it seems to be a mostly the hate mail comes from a particular kind of Christian reader. So that hasn't happened on the other sides. Like you don't get fundamentalists from either of the other.
I don't. In fact, so far the people who've been most enthusiastic about the book have been Muslims, and that probably means the most to me, because that was the tradition I worked hardest on understanding. I consulted so many different people and so much literature just to get a sort of sense of this story from the Muslim perspective. Okay. And so I was thrilled that I'm getting that reception.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What when the venues that you're going to, you're a guest at the Jewish Book Fair, what are those receptions like when people talk to you about the book? Are they always, as you say, sort of vague about why they like it? Or do they sometimes say, you know, this was a story that I had long clung to sort of as an individualistic idea, but thank you for bringing it forward in that way?
This is one of my favorite things to do, is to go talk to religious organizations. So mm-hmm. I've talked a lot to Unitarians, Episcopalians, Protestants, sort of the liberal Protestants, and I've talked to Reform Jews and Conservative Jews as well. And what often happens for people in religious traditions is that this is a story that they too have struggled with. And for the last talk I gave to a Jewish community, a couple of the women came up afterwards and said, thank you so much for writing this book, because we've always struggled with the story of Sarah pushing the second wife out. Mm-hmm. And my explanation, they said, which I loved, my explanation really helped them redeem Sarah and understand okay. Sarah's behavior more. So I was really glad to okay. hear that.
And the explanation is that it's a cultural thing at the time?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I'll see if I can do the short version of it. But the first time we hear Abraham speak in the Bible, he's actually talking to Sarah, and they're about to enter Egypt. And he says to Sarah, Sarah, he says, I see you are a beautiful woman. Could you please lie to the Egyptians and tell them that you are my sister and not my wife, so that they will not kill me for your on your sake, because he knew that they were going to want her for the Pharaoh's harem. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't say anything, but in fact, she does make it into the Pharaoh's harem. The Pharaoh wants her. She's so gorgeous. And the early Jewish commentators, by the way, are practically R-rated in their descriptions of how gorgeous she was, you know, her thighs, her everything. So she's in the harem. And again, the Bible is a little iffy about what happens there, which is interesting. But how close do she and the Pharaoh get to, you know, intimacy? Mm-hmm. But ultimately, God rescues her from the Pharaoh's clutches, and she and Abraham go back into the promised land. And then years pass, and there's no exchange between husband and wife that we hear of. So the reader's left with this sort of sense of unresolved stuff. Like, how come Abraham never says he's sorry? And how come Sarah never gets mad at him? That never gets resolved for us, the reader. And then Sarah speaks for the first time in the Bible, and it's about 13 years later, and Abraham's just come back from war. And instead of saying, "Hi, honey, you know, I'm so glad you're back from war," she says, "Here, take my maid, Hagar, and sleep with her, and see if we can have a baby through Hagar, because I can't have a baby, and we can adopt that baby for our own." Mm. And I've always thought, what a strange way to greet your husband after you haven't seen him for so long. And why? I mean, we know Sarah can't have a baby, and we know she is thinking, well, maybe I can have a baby through my maid, but still it seems like a strange, perhaps hostile way to greet one's husband.
Tell me about your book on Anne Bradstreet. We'll talk a little bit about that. I know that you've written about her. She was a poet in 17th century America, just a great time to be in America, a great time to be a poet in America. I think there were like three of them at the time. So tell me how that came about and what, you know, that precedes this. So you're starting on a trend of these remarkable women. Maybe you've got things always come in threes. So your third book will be about another remarkable woman. But what was the Anne Bradstreet book like for you?
Well, thank you so much for asking me about the Anne Bradstreet book. I loved writing that book. You know, I was actually raised in the Midwest, and I had wonderful teachers when I was a girl growing up. But I always knew I wanted to be a writer, and I especially loved poetry. And the only female writers I had ever heard of were, you know, the famous suicides, sadly. So Sylvia Plath, you know, Anne Sexton, and then, you know, a little Virginia Woolf thrown in there for good measure. Mm-hmm. And so I think in my mind, if you were going to be a woman writer, it was very uncomfortably mixed with self-destruction. And so I was really very consciously looking for a woman teacher or a woman role model who had had a successful and rich and happy life and was also a great poet. And I kept looking for her as a teacher, a living teacher. I never found her. I went to schmancy graduate school. You know, I worked with Nobel Prize winning men.
That's Boston University's schmancy graduate school.
And I never found her. And then I moved to this little town north of Boston, and I went for a run one day. I was supposed to start teaching, and I hadn't prepared for class, and
The best syllabi come from is when you run away from them and then come back.
Very fast. Mm-hmm. And this syllabus was prepared by the school. I was going to be teaching the syllabus. Oh, okay. I hadn't made it up myself. And the first person on the syllabus was some stupid Puritan poet, Anne Bradford, somebody. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I could read her or I could go for a run. So I went for a run, and I practically fall over a plaque on the house next door to me that says, "The poet Anne Bradstreet used to live here." And I thought, oh my goodness. I went home. I started to read her. I fell in love with her.
It was a 70s duplex. It was very strange.
She lived in a 70s duplex?
Who knew? But this also tells all your students that instead of doing their reading, they should go for a run.
They should definitely go for a run.
Right, yeah, you heard that here first. Go for a run. Don't read Anne Bradstreet. So when you started to read Anne Bradstreet then?
Oh, I found this smart, irreverent, amazing woman that I had never been taught in school, and I could not believe it. She's so terrific. My students fell in love with her, too. I mean, she is 17th century, so she's hard for us to understand, but so is Shakespeare. You know, once you get through the language barrier and you find this smart, 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 funny, passionate woman.
What is she funny about? Because, you know, I've done a little bit of reading in that time, and it doesn't strike me as a particularly amusing time. You know, there were other, you know, sort of earlier and later periods, the Reform has some really funny people in it, like John Wilmot. you know, speaking of R-rated, that strike me
as funny,
which tells you something about my sense of humor. But America at that time doesn't strike me as particularly funny.
Parts of her that are not funny, but the parts that I was very engaged by, perhaps because I just had my first baby, was when she writes about motherhood. And I think one of the reasons that she, in fact, became very popular amongst modernist poets in the beginning of the 20th century is that she has this really interesting thing she does. So when she's writing about motherhood, she suddenly takes the point of view of the baby, and she says, oh, my mother, I'm going to do a bad 21st century translation of it, but essentially, my mother did wear down to the bone while she bye-bye sung, which was a lullaby apparently that they sang. So the baby's perspective is actually sort of funny because you look at the mother and the baby's perspective on the mother is not the mother's perspective at all. Mm-hmm. And we also get to hear this great sort of 17th century slang in the midst of a pretty formal poem. And I think that that alternation between the sort of high formal stuff and slang is really interesting. I mean, I really like it, but I think my favorite part about her, and it's the part I can kind of identify with the most, is it's actually not humor at all. It's this sort of mixture of ambition and self-deprecation. So she will say things like, I am just a simple woman, and my skills are really limited, and ye men, ye will always triumph over us. And I shouldn't write about history, and I shouldn't write about war, but, and then 2,000 lines of poetry later about history and war. And then she says, oh, but simple I, according to my skill, these 2,000 lines of history and warfare were really hard for me to write, and my pen is wobbly, and I feel very weak. But now, here come 2,000 more lines of history and war. And I love that because her sort of self-doubt keeps working its way into these long history poems. So you're reading about Cleopatra, you know, which, by the way, she really loved violence. You're reading about Cleopatra, and then suddenly you have Anne Bradstreet saying, oh, but, you know, this is really hard work for me, and I do hope that you, my reader, are being patient with me. And, you know, it's hard with all these babies. She had 8 babies crying, but I will persevere. It's so human.
What's the best part about being a writer for you? What do you most enjoy about it?
I love the opportunity to reflect and think and read great books. And, you know, I thought it was the greatest privilege in the world to sit with the Bible every day and try and make sense of that text. I just thought, I can't believe that this is what I get to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in an earlier era, we would have described the process that, you know, we writers go through as a religious or spiritual experience. But that is very much, I think, what it feels like to me.
Okay. What's the worst part about being a writer?
The loneliness, the isolation, the sitting at the desk and nothing interesting is happening, and you read the words and you think, ugh, this is really drivel. And then for me, the endless snacking.
Snacking is a bad part?
When it's endless, that is how I cope with not knowing what to write
that
next.
That seems like a good part of it. You know, if you were starving, that would be the bad
part.
But if you
have 10 minutes of snacking.
Of snacking is difficult to get through.
But, no, that's the fun part.
Oh, okay.
It's the endless. I've broken teeth on hard candies.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. I didn't know that as a writer hazard for a writer.
Have these weird habits.
Have broken teeth?
Well,
no,
they smoke, the people who don't.
What's the worst writing job you've had? Of all the things that you've written, what was the most difficult, we'll say?
As being a writer?
Yeah. Of the books you've written a couple books of poetry, right? You've written about Anne Bradstreet. You've written The Woman Who Named God. You've written probably a lot of responses to students. I think I found right there what the most difficult thing is. It responding to students, that's the most difficult kind of writing.
No, you know what I thought was most challenging is I just got a call from Harvard, actually, to write the chronology. They're bringing out Anne Bradstreet, a new annotated version to sort of standardize their John Harvard series of classics. So they called me up and said, would I do the chronology of her life and the bibliography? And it was sort of a grown-up moment for me. I guess I thought, well, I guess I am the person to do this. So yes, I will be a grown up and I will do this. And then I know, because I spent so many years in that period, I know that some of our dating is a little complicated. So we're not sure exactly when the Bradstreets moved to this town or that town. But for the sake of a chronology, you got to write 1641. And so I would put these sort of stretches of time in my chronology, 1640 to 1642. I found it very challenging just to do that without getting to write a narrative of explanation. And I saw why I don't do that kind of thing for a living.
What's the worst job you've had that was great preparation for being a writer?
Selling jewelry.
Really?
Yes.
Tell me about why.
That looks so beautiful on you. You know, when I can really picture you wearing that out to dinner or, you know, it's safe. Sapphires, you can wear them to the beach. You can take showers with them.
You can wear sapphires to the beach.
Yeah, you don't ever have to worry about them. And I don't know, there's just something kind of magical, don't you think, about...
I don't buy jewelry often enough to know, but you really went into the spiel
Well,
how long did you do that?
A couple of years.
A couple of years.
Yeah. Okay.
Was that when you were in graduate school or...
It was between college and graduate school when I was trying to be a poet, you know, writing
because
poems.
Who's your biggest influence when you're writing? Do you ever try to channel somebody or think that you get done with something and say, that reminds me of X and I'm proud of that?
Well, you know, when you write the lives of people, they become your people. You're living with them and they become your great teachers. So when I was writing this book, when I was writing Woman Who Named God, I was living very much with the Bible and with the God character and with the Abraham character and Sarah character, and I find them all to be great teachers. And right now I'm writing a book about Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Shelley.
Okay.
And I am so inspired and thrilled by Mary Wollstonecraft at the moment. I mean, she is very annoying and whiny and self-righteous and complainy, but boy, was she brave. So I think who I write about, I don't really choose them. I'm sure you've heard this before. They sort of choose me. Mm-hmm. And then I live with them for years.
They're whiny?
Oh, yes.
And so when you're writing about them and you're creating some dialogue, what's your revision process on that when you go back and look at it and you think, oh, I've made her too whiny or not whiny enough or, you know, she's not saying things that are smart enough because you don't have the verbatim translations, right? All of this stuff is you have to create this dialogue.
Well, so with Mary Wollstonecraft, I've got all of her letters. So I actually do have her words that I can just put in. So I don't have to make anything up.
But those are letters. I mean, if someone's speaking, I write differently than I speak in a letter. So when you do have dialogue, though, you have to
I think that as a writer, it's our job, really, to make these people come alive on the page. And so I think we have a sense, and our editors have a sense, and our friends, thank goodness for friends, have a sense that something doesn't ring true.
Mm-hmm. I greatly appreciate you coming to talk to us today. The book, again, is The Woman Who Named God. Charlotte Gordon is the author, and it is available on Amazon. Thank you very much, and have
a great
day.
Thank you, Doug.
From the Center for the Study of Teaching of Writing, this has been Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Until next time, keep writing.